Well, welcome to the last in our Darwin College lecture series on the theme of serendipity. I know that a lot of you have been to a lot of these lectures, which is wonderful from our point of view as a college. And as you know, during the course of the term, they've talked about the part played by serendipity over a wide range of thinking, astronomy, history, physics, writing, politics, microbiology, and then last week, how serendipity enhanced our understanding of the origins of the universe. Well, this week, perhaps appropriately, we come to the part it may have played in our understanding our origins as people, as human beings. The title is Understanding Humans, Serendipity and Anthropology, and our fascinatingly qualified speaker is Professor Richard Leakey. Normally, I would say what distinguished academies Professor Leakey had studied at, but he was a high school dropout after his schooling in Kenya, and he comes from a Kenyan family, and he lives in Kenya now. But clearly, he's very distinguished anthropologist parents, Lewis and Mary, inspired him, because when he decided what he wanted to do, he continued their search for signs of early man in East Africa. And in this search, he was able to make some of the most remarkable discoveries in his subject, and he also published extensively about it. But I think perhaps as impressive as this academic achievement was the scale and courage of Professor Leakey's contribution to contemporary people in East Africa. His work for the Museum Service and the Wildlife Service of Kenya led to his becoming a Kenyan Member of Parliament, the Secretary of the Cabinet, and the head of the Kenyan Civil Service. Professor Leakey knows at first hand how the fragility of human remains is matched by the fragility of human societies. And it's a great privilege to invite him to speak to you tonight. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction. Let me first, if I may, be a little direct and tell you that I seem to have eaten something today. I think it was a recycled mushroom for breakfast that has led to some discomfort. And the reason I came in and walked out, I just wanted to see where I needed to go. If I unceremoniously leave, which I hope I can achieve, please don't leave. I'll be right back. It's probably better if I exit left rather than subject you to what could be an embarrassing few seconds. So it may not happen, but there it is. So with that aside, and with the best intentions in the world, let me tackle this eighth in this series, Serendipity, and begin by saying that I know a lot of people but don't have many friends. And I do have a couple of friends who I spoke to about this word, serendipity. One of whom was French and one was French-Italian. And both assured me that there's no such word in their languages. And if such a word does not exist in their language, it's obviously not a concept to worry you too much if you're going to give a lecture. So I found that reassuring, but I kept getting emails and messages from this college about how the series had gone and how this topic has been addressed through all the different sciences that we've heard of a few moments ago, and obviously it just couldn't be dismissed as easily as that. And so I gave a lot of thought to it, and I even moved myself to look up several dictionaries in English and see what they said, and it didn't help at all in terms of where we're going, because it increasingly looked like the sort of question I used to get at school that caused me to drop out. And they were questions that look easy, but in fact are quite difficult. And first of all, you not only have to know the answer, but you have to understand the question. And then I really started to panic. So here we are. At sea at loss, but quite willing to have a shot at talking to you about serendipity in the story of our origins and in anthropology. Let me start right away and say that I think it's important in anthropology and evolution to be very careful not to get caught up with the notion that serendipity might imply that there's a faculty to take advantage of chance, because in the sense of evolution, what is it that has that faculty? Is it the discoverer or the discovered that had that faculty? And I think we would not want to fall into the trap that has been so hotly debated in Cambridge as the result of the work of Charles Darwin, to suggest that there is a plan, or that there is a design, or that there is a way that was always anticipated. And so when choices and chances arose, the organism somehow consciously or used its faculty to say, yes, it would be beneficial in terms of selection to take this option. And I think that there will be, and I think there is a tendency today to somehow fall into that trap. And I take the position that I suppose best known through the work, or some of the work of Richard Dawkins, when he wrote The Blind Watchmaker, and suggests that there is no such faculty in life, or life other than ours, that would drive our evolutionary choices in a conscious sense. And I think that there have been opportunities that have been exploited, and we will certainly talk about that in terms of the main steps that I believe have been followed to get us where we are. But long before we get to that, I would like to perhaps take another tack, and one which, again, we don't often think about. But in this whole dispute that Darwin has, I suppose, taken credit for having started, and that's the evolution of our species, that there has been, I think, at times, particularly from the theological right, as opposed to the theological community, but the theological right, that, you know, these fossils that we find and we talk about, I mean, they don't add up to very much. And, you know, is it really appropriate to use these few scraps of fossil bones to suggest such a departure from what used to be the perceived wisdom? Obviously, that has changed, but let's just talk about the fossil record for a minute and relate that to what I guess would be a common usage of the term serendipity, as I understand it. And then think for a minute as to how absolutely remarkable it is that there are any fossils at all. This seems to be the more amazing thing than that there are so few. That there are any is astonishing. And let me just run you through, because a lot of you may not have thought through. Your chance of becoming a fossil, I would wager, is zero. And it's a hard thing to have to accept, but it is. The chances of a natural living organism anywhere is pretty remote. And the chances of being an early ape, bipedal ape, whatever we want to define it later on, becoming a fossil, is the probability is such that it is astonishing that we find them at all. And let me go through. First of all, when you die, from whatever cause, you have to die somewhere where there's a reasonable hope that everything about you doesn't get consumed by scavengers. Vultures, hyenas, saber-toothed cats, lions. And we've got, and have had for millions of years, rather frail bones. And they're rather like chicken bones with cats and dogs. They can get crunched up terribly easily, and there's nothing left. You try looking at a chicken bone you give to your dog, or look at what happens to the chicken if the dog gets it while your back's turned. And there's nothing there that you could, after 10 minutes, discern as having been a chicken. And not my dog's experience, anyway. So surviving the process of immediately post-death is pretty unlikely. Then having got through that hurdle, your bits are then lying around, and they somehow have to be buried quite fast to stop them being destroyed by sunlight and rain and changing temperatures. And so they have to get caught up in a sedimentary process where they get scrunched into the mud by other animals walking by, or they get washed into the edge of a lake and get buried under the silt. And so to go from stage one to stage two is in itself fairly unlikely. And once in the water, if the water has the wrong chemical balance, too much of something, too little of something else, the bones simply disintegrate themselves very fast, and those potentials have gone, and you have nothing. So you have to get caught up in a sedimentary sequence where the soil is not too acidic and whether the right elements in the soil for the process of calcification and preservation or whatever process is involved in forming this fossil to actually happen. Now, that should not be taken as a given, but it does. Those circumstances do agree. So you get caught up in a sedimentary sequence, and if it's an active sedimentary area, as many of these are, you gradually get covered by layers and layers of other sediments, and you could end up, your bones could end up, several hundred, if not 1,000 meters below the present-day surface. It's no good being a fossil if you're 1,000 meters down in the story that we're talking about. So serendipity, maybe, but geological processes then have to bring all this up again to the present-day surface. And this is earth movement, it's earthquakes, tilting, erosion. And lo and behold, several million years later, these bits come back on the surface and lie around on the surface, now subjected once again to not just erosion, but to trampling feet of passing herds of animals, goats, sheep, buffalo, elephant, and whatever. And the chances of lying on the surface in the hot sun and remaining as intact as you were when you got buried is again, pretty high numbers of chance that you won't make it. And then on top of all that, you've got to be found. And to be found, you have to come to the surface in this sedimentary process that's been affected by tectonic activity. And you have to come to the surface in an area where there's very little vegetation, so that when your bit is lying on the surface to be seen by some fellow like myself or my colleagues, it's not covered with grass and leaf litter, but it's actually there, and you can see it and say, look, there's an ancestor's bone. Now, you work out those probabilities of any of you getting in through that cycle. Not very high. And so, that we have any is astonishing. That we have so many, including almost complete skeletons, is absolutely incredible. And I think we should recognize that in that sense, there is an element of luck and exploitation of opportunity, whatever definition you want to use, that you might want to call serendipity, that gives rise to a fossil record in the first place. And I think that's quite significant. As I said in my opening comments, I think that the concept of serendipity has to be taken more from the standpoint of the discoverer than the discovered. And how that relates to what I've just said is difficult to be sure, but I think certainly the individual organism had no part in its fate in terms of turning up in the museum laboratory shelves. So what about this issue of serendipity and the faculty of being able to recognize by chance? Well, there are countless examples of this, and I think it's a much safer track to follow, and it's often quite fascinating how one thing has led to another, and because it's led to another, there's been an opportunity to do something unexpectedly that gives you a different result than that which you might have thought of. And my understanding, that's broadly what this is all about. But before we do that, let's also recognize that there are certainly what I suppose biologists and evolutionary biologists in particular refer to secondary and primary adaptations, where you may have adapted in a particular direction for following a particular pressure, but in the process of getting from here to here, you actually have other advantages that can be selected for that weren't originally the purpose of the adaptation that can then lead the organism in a totally different direction in terms of survival. And there are lots of examples for that, and I guess we can we can come back to those as we go through this discussion. But I want to separate out the three areas that I'm talking about and be very careful not to suggest that our ancestors and our forebears somehow had a faculty for selecting or choosing which way they wanted to exploit circumstances that had arisen as a result of chance. So let's come to the whole issue of the discoverer. Well, I know that in our family history, there's been a great deal given to Leakey's luck. And the idea was that my father before me and me subsequently, and I suppose my daughters who follow me in the same field, are often dismissed as just being lucky. That's a nice thought that we're lucky. Sometimes it doesn't feel as if one's lucky. One works extremely hard, and nobody talks about that part of the whole thing. And no matter how lucky we are, we're not going to find the complete skeleton of Homo erectus here on these green grass fields that are behind the colleges. Luck won't help you at all there. So there have to be things that you can take advantage of that are not necessarily luck, and if you're better at taking advantage of it than other people, maybe that's luck. But I worry about it being luck, but maybe it's luck. And in that sense, we as a family have been extraordinarily lucky. But I would put it down to the fact that we were in the right place at the right time with the right opportunities. And I say to young students all the time, is that everybody in life sees so many opportunities, and most people in everyday life look at them going by and they say, wow, that's an opportunity. And then, then it's gone out the exit, and then you hang around a bit and another one comes along and you smile and think, there's another one, look. And it's gone. And what my father told me, if an opportunity arises, grab it. If it stings or bites, well, then let it go and grab the next one. But don't let it get out until you know what it can do. And so I think when you see opportunity, you should definitely take it and accept that there are high risks sometimes in taking opportunities. And I think it is very much an element or characteristic of being willing to take chance that you can exploit what they call luck. And there again, I suppose, in a sense, it gets back to what serendipity was supposed to be about when it was coined back in the early 1700s. So, what are these opportunities? Well, let's just take a few examples. And I guess one of the first examples I would give is the fact that my father was persuaded, he was born in Kenya, and he was long persuaded that East Africa or Africa would be the birthplace of humanity. Charles Darwin had implied as much in his writings, partly derived from the evidence for the great apes, the chimpanzees and the gorillas that lived so broadly in Africa. And it was politically not correct at that time to think of humans coming from Africa. You could have near humans, Australopithecus if you have to have something like that, but not humans. As you know, many of you know, and I don't want to dwell on it, but the success with which Piltdown was maintained as a good hoax, but not a very good hoax, was to do with a certain element, this an anathema of having African ancestors. Bad enough to have Asian ones. But now there's this fellow suggesting an African ancestors. And so a good Brit would be a much better show. And so let's not look too closely at the evidence, because this would be helpful. And I think it played a big part in forming people's attitudes to some of the early work they made. But my father got into trouble and fell out with people here in Cambridge, and he took off in disgrace to back to Africa. And I think if he hadn't fallen out with people here, and he had decided to make his career here with an establishment wife and everything was going to be on the line, I doubt very much whether he would have done all the things that he did in East Africa that led to these great discoveries and stimulated so many. Is having a divorce and being precocious a form of serendipity and being thrown out of college? I'm not sure, but it may be. It's another aspect that you need to think about. But he certainly, that happened to him. And as a result of that, He found himself in a country with enormous opportunities to pursue archaeology and human evolution. As I said, last year I was here briefly for a ceremony, and I was asked to speak very briefly at a ceremony. And I made the remark that my father, when he was at Cambridge as a student, was destined to become a student of theology, a cleric, because his parents were very much religious and believed very strongly that their offspring should follow in the ministry. And he was to be trained in the classics and theology and then go back and lead the masses in enlightenment through teachings of Christ. You all know more about that than I do. He wasn't, he said, very enthusiastic, but he was doing it as a diligent son, and he got playing in a rugby match for John's, in a practice match, I think, where they were trying to select the university players. He got kicked in the head and got a serious skull fracture and concussion. And when he came around and was obviously going to live, they decided that, you know, he should not think for a while. That's a rather nice treatment, I would have thought. So he applied and went off to be an interpreter, speaking fluent Swahili as he did, German expedition that was going to then Tanganyika to collect fossil dinosaurs. And so he went off as an interpreter and became absolutely riveted by the evidence for early life in the form of dinosaurs. And so, but when he came back, having mended his head sufficiently, he said, no more of that clerical stuff, I want to go into archaeology and prehistory. And so he then changed his career dramatically as a result of the opportunity that he got when he observed fossil dinosaurs being collected by paleontologists in southern Tanganyika by German expedition. And so one might say that was some aspect or some element of serendip, if you like, playing its hand. Well, hard to say, but it's been suggested. Then he was apparently sufficiently popular with the German expedition that they said that there was a chance to go to Olduvai as a student, a young fellow. Would he like to go back to Tanzania a few years later and actually join them at Olduvai, which was then a known site with archaeology, but nothing had really been found. And he went back and visited Olduvai for the first time in the late 20s. And became hugely impressed by the fact that there were bones of extinct animals lying from an erosional surface mixed with what he took to be stone artifacts like hand axes, the remnants of a culture that's subsequently been referred to as the Acheulean Y, I don't know, but anyway, nice, clearly made objects made from stone. And so he decided that Olduvai was the place that these things lived, and that if he could find the maker of the stone tools living with extinct animals, then he would have world's earliest man. And so he set his sails purely as a result of those events that led to there. And he got very much involved, and it's not my purpose to discuss those at length, but these were purely chance happenings that were not pre-imagined or pre-planned. It just, something happened and he went that road, and then something happened and he went that road. And I guess that's part of what we're talking about. And then, having got established, in 1957, at one of the Olduvai sites, my parents worked there every year for two or three weeks, sometimes a month, in very difficult circumstances, and very, very rarely found anything that lent anything to his ideas about human origins being there. But then they found a nice big fat molar of an Australopithecine, and we're going to. He was convinced. As it happens, he was probably wrong, but he was convinced that if there was one molar, there must be a good number of others, and they must have been sitting in a piece of bone like a jaw or a maxilla. And therefore, the thing to do was now dig this place up and get his evidence and launch his career another time. So this was to be, and he persuaded an Englishman called Charles Boys to give him some money. It wasn't a lot of money, but they went off. I remember very clearly them going off and saying, we're going to stay now and excavate this site, and you'll hear we've got the big fellow, we've got the chap who made these tools. Well, I was at the last phases of my reluctant schoolboy years. I was 16 and looking for every opportunity. And my father had the presence of mind to decide that he wished to have filmed the discovery, which he hadn't made, but he thought he would make it. And so he arranged for a man who some of you will remember, some of you won't, called Armand Dennis, who was a wildlife photographer who lived in East Africa, very famous. And Armand Dennis had known my father and thought, well, if he really did make this discovery and he could get it on film, this would be a particularly important piece of Armand Dennis's television work outputs. And so Armand Dennis arranged for his photographer, who was an Australian called Des Bartlett, to go down, a couple of cars, and I was within a month of getting to the end of term and thought it was time I could leave anyway. The last month was just exams. Why not go early? So I negotiated. I just left. And there was some delay, and we were delayed 3 days. And so the excavation didn't start for 3 days, and my parents had to find something to do because they were convinced they were going to make this discovery. And in the 3 days, they sort of footled around. My father got sick and didn't go out much. My mother went off to looking in places near where they were camped and discovered the skull of Zinjanthropus. The day we arrived, she'd made the discovery. So the day after we arrived, they filmed the uncovering and it captured the world's attention. Now, is that serendipity? I don't know. I mean, it was just one of those extraordinary things that happened. And had it not been for the film and the photography and the coverage, it seems to me unlikely that the search for human origins at Olduvai and later in other East African sites would have got off to the start that it got off. It was just one of those pure chance events that happened. And they never did go back and excavate the other site for about 10 years, but focused on the site that was found when they were waiting for us. And then nearby found other sites, and the whole saga of the discovery at Olduvai then took off and took place. And how much of that was Leakey's luck? How much of that was serendipity? How much of it was just damned hard work? I don't know. But it was an extraordinary sequence of events that were all chance that resulted in this sudden opening up of a massive new interest in human origins in East Africa. And it, perhaps more importantly, because the National Geographic Society were involved, took the film, the publicity that it generated funding, and so the work continued. And that really has to be, and it's 50 years next July from when this discovery was made, and it has to be the trigger that has done so much to get us where we are in understanding. Of course, there are other experiences that you could probably look at, but let's then take one or two more, which are slightly different. I went up and started looking at Lake Turkana for fossils in 68, and we were very lucky. There was nothing but good fortune rather than good luck. The fossil hominids sort of falling out of the rocks everywhere, and we were in very short order able to collect a significant number of important specimens, which was good for me because I had taken the initiative to go there, and because I had taken the initiative, they were my fossils, they weren't your fossils. And so I was able to say to my father and mother, no, this is mine. You know, don't give me your scientists, I will find my scientists, and I will lead this myself. And so, of course, I put together a team around me who were very willing to work with me because I had the best bones. And so we had some magnificent years, and it's not my purpose to go through these, but what I would say is that, again, pure chance led to some incredible discoveries, but very different chance. I remember in one particular occasion, we had found a mandible that was broken, and there was a fair chance that we could find more of this mandible if we did some sieving or screening or whatever sense you like. And so I had sent up a few people to screen it, and they would be taken out by car, left in the morning and picked up in the evening. It was right on the Ethiopian border, and there was a certain amount of animosity between the Ethiopian tribesmen who were then there and the presence of strangers. And they were busy screening and collecting dirt and looking for these bits, and several shots rang out, and rifle shots, and they rang out not just noise, but there was actually, like on the movies, dirt being shot up in the air about 2 or 3 feet from where they were sitting, and they didn't think this was at all humorous, and decided they would return to the civvying and took to their heels. And, you know, it's flat desert country, very little place to hide. And there was a cliff about the height of this room was sort of scrambled up, and there was a big evergreen bush growing halfway up the cliff on a little ledge. And they thought the thing to do would be get up there and get behind the bush where they could see what was happening and they couldn't be seen, and they could then make some decisions what to do. So they scrambled up this cliff as fast as they could with three people, hid behind the bushes, and no more shots rang out. They never saw anybody. But they weren't quite as enthusiastic as they might have been to get back to work. And so it was hot, and they were sort of sitting, fiddling around, moving stones, and lo and behold, there was another mandible. And nobody in their right mind would have ever gone up this cliff to hide behind a bush, and we never would have found that mandible, which turned out to be a very important find in the discoveries. Now, is that serendipity? I don't know. Is it luck? I don't know. But, you know, it was an unplanned consequence of another unplanned event that could have ended badly, and it ended extremely well, and nobody got killed, and we got a new find of major importance that remains to this day to be one of the high points in those expeditions. So that, if you like, is a form of this story that I wanted to tell. But let's then turn it around and look at another aspect of this, because we still have a bit of time. I'm still with you. I'm not sure how much longer, but we seem to be doing all right at the moment. What about these evolutionary events, these adaptations? I mean, how much of that is the same sort of thing? One of the big debates today that we're still talking about is the attainment of upright posture. Was this an exploitation of a previous adaptation, or was the real selective pressure to become upright? How much can we say for the idea that we used to be four-legged and knuckle-walking, and that under pressure we got up and kept our hands free, and we no longer used our wrists for support but started using our hands, and we grew a long thumb, we got the manipulative hands, and that this was somehow a result of some huge pressure that led to this and led to that? What we don't know is the answer, and you can speculate. But it's not impossible that you might find that there were smaller primates living somewhere we haven't yet found in Africa, though already largely bipedal in a totally different way, and hadn't taken the step that our ancestors took of actually starting to use their hands for quite sophisticated purposes. And I think one of the huge questions remaining today, and one which undoubtedly is going to attract lots of research interest over the next decade or two, is pushing back to where it first happened. Did becoming upright happen once, or did it happen several times? Did it happen with our ancestors, or did it happen with something that later on was our ancestor? It's a possibility, and I'm not saying it's so, but I think one has to recognize that we know so little about the origin of bipedalism in the real sense that it's very hard to predict which way it'll be going. And I think we need to, as a science, leaving aside these issues that we've been discussing, recognize that there's so much more discovery before we can even sensibly speculate on the origin of bipedality. However, let's then say that there is an ape in terms of a large ground-living primate that goes around on two legs and has hands that are capable of picking things up and doing things with it. When did this happen? Does it really matter? All of those questions can be posed, but it seems to me that upright posture in a big-bodied ape may be the first reliable definition of being on the human trajectory. As I said earlier in a discussion with some colleagues, some students, the great mistake that was made, and it was probably made sort of around here, is to suggest that we separated from the apes, and that's what the squabble's been about. It hasn't happened. We are the fifth ape. And this ascension or descent from the apes is something that may be happening one day, but it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, we're just another ape who do things very differently. And I think if we'd ever got round to thinking about that, we might have had far less contention in the story of origins. But then, of course, being separate from the apes was important if the idea of evolution was to be accepted, because you could somehow distance yourself from them to us. And this was obviously important in those days, 150 years ago, when it was first a topic of frequent discussion. But we're an upright ape, we're large-bodied, we seem to have been under pressure to survive. It seems to be we may have left the deep forest cover. I suggest because we don't know. But having hands that are no longer supporting us, like gorillas and chimps, and having fingers that, because of that, can be much more manipulative, we started living a different way of life. And at some point, somewhere along the line, meat became important, and accessing meat is very difficult if you're a big ape, unless you've got big canine teeth. Because you can't tear flesh with hands without claws, and you can't tear flesh without large, sharp canine teeth that can tear. So, I mean, don't believe me, go and try. Get yourselves a fresh rabbit, and it's hard enough. Get something up to the size of a dog or a deer, and see if you can tear it apart with your bare hands. You won't until it's putrid. Once it's putrid, you may not want to do it. So being able to access meat obviously had survival value, because meat is highly nutritious. It comes in decent packets. You can share it. There's a whole syndrome of behavioral responses that you can allude to that. But clearly we didn't get manipulative hands because we wanted to eat meat. We were able to access meat by making stone tools because we had manipulative hands. And we needed to because we had small teeth. But is there any relation, a sequential relationship, in terms of when these different things happen? Probably not. And so maybe that, in a sense, is exploiting an earlier adaptation that gave rise to possibilities that the original adaptation, being upright, was never had anything to do with. And I guess you could accept that line of thinking and argument in terms of serendipity in the process of evolution. But I think, again, one needs to be very careful, because we don't know enough about it, and we don't know exactly what the sequence was for these events to happen. So anyway, you get to upright, free hands, manipulative hands. Some of them, or some species, or a species, was now gaining access to carcasses because it could break stones and get a sharp edge, and it could get at meat, and with meat it could do all sorts of things that it couldn't do before, and particularly it could share food. So if you just got a few seeds, you don't want to share them because you don't get enough to fill your belly, and you certainly don't want to share them with anybody else. But if you can take a haunch off an animal that a lion killed, it's quite a reasonable package that you can share. And so you can begin to show things like compassion. You can begin to show behavior patterns, which we identify with being particularly human today. But there you are. You're still small-brained, and you're still probably at what people would sort of happily call the grunting phase. Not particularly sophisticated in one's thinking, although, you know, do we know that they weren't? I don't think we do know that they weren't, but we assume that they weren't. So this goes along for a while, and suddenly you start seeing not only crude stone tools, but you seem to get some evidence that the brain is getting bigger. The head sits on our shoulders, remains more or less the same size in terms of body weight, but the shape of the head changes so that your brain gets bigger and your face gets smaller, becomes more orthognathic, less pronating. There are lots of changes that go on. Why? Was this because we had a better diet? Was this because we were now selected for skills? For those who are slightly smarter get more food. Those who are slightly smarter with more food raise bigger families and better families. I mean, there's a whole series of circles that are probably interlinked in some way that you can discuss until you're bored stiff, and we don't know the answer. But what did happen was that bipedal hominid, using tools, around 2 million years, started to get a bigger brain. And once the brain got bigger, went through periods when it didn't get much bigger and stayed stable, but you do seem to see in the limited archaeological traces some evidence of a more complex lifestyle. And of course, what has been very interesting in the last decade or two is we're beginning to look at the natural history, the biology of these creatures. And in particular, it's important to think about the delayed childhood, where our children are born more and more as incompetent little things that need a lot of parental care early on. And they tend to stay longer with their parents because they're so incompetent. And in the process, they learn a lot more from their parents. And so you can see in the developmental biology of some of the fossils of infants that there has been actually some response that is more than just a bigger brain. What led to what? This is, you know, you get teleological in this discussion, and you've got to be very careful not to do that. But there is clearly evidence that some things happened that weren't perhaps in the original plan, if there had indeed been a plan, which there wasn't. But you can start to tell fairy tales, at least. And some people, unfortunately, believe fairy tales. Others don't. I don't. But there's a fascinating story that goes with becoming human, right up to the point, of course, where you have a perfectly satisfactory human like us 200,000 years ago in Africa. All seems to be going extremely well, not particularly sophisticated. Who knows what they were up to, but they were making tools and they had fire and they were hunting and they were collecting and they were fairly all over the world. And then apparently, if the geneticists are right and the evidence is right, some 65, 70,000 years ago, something else happens, and suddenly there's a small population that gives rise to all of us, modern people, whether we're from the southern tip of South America, whether we're talking about people in Central Australia, Aboriginals, or whether we're talking about people sitting here in Cambridge. We're all more or less closely related to a population that seems to have left Africa this side of 100,000 years. Exactly when? I've heard from people here and others that language suggests itself to be within all the languages we know today are also within this side of 100,000 years. What happened? I mean, what gave rise to this phenomenal change? What enabled something just like everything else but slightly different to take over everybody else's territory and repopulate the world at the consequence to all those that had been there before? Is it a new species? What was it? We don't know. Is it because we had a big brain? Well, we'd had a big brain for a long time. It wasn't because we had a big brain. What exactly happened? And we don't know. So that's all very well, and probably related to speech, I would guess. Speech in the sense of being able to talk about things that haven't yet happened as well as things that did happen and put it all in the context for planning purposes. And it's quite useful to have that faculty to not just think about what you're going to do next, but what you did before that might impact on what you should do next. And talking about experiences is very critical to the process of being what we are. So that's all very well. But then suddenly, it's not sudden, of course, but in a relatively short space of time, a few thousand years, people develop, not all, but some people develop the ability to start domesticating and living in one place and settling down and making pottery and things like that. After a history that goes, intelligent humans going back, large-brained humans going back a couple of million years, suddenly in the last 8,000 or 9,000 years, people start making pottery and vessels and doing it in a particular way that you can identify with certain geographic centers in different parts of the world. Putting things, cooking it. Origins of not just settlement, but settlement in sufficient size that you begin to get the roots of, quote, civilization. So what happened? I mean, why didn't that happen 20,000 years before? Why did it happen then? And what is going to happen next? Well, who knows? Who cares, in a sense? But what is intriguing is that there are these events that you can record archaeologically. We still can say, in many cases, how but never why. And I think that's a significant part of the story that we can tell. It's a very exciting one. As far as I'm personally concerned, the understanding of our origins and the better understanding of anthropology is, if you like, now getting down to detailed text. I think for the last 100 years, perhaps a little more, we've been really writing the headlines and some of the subheads, but we haven't really got into dealing with the text. And it's today, with the interface of biochemistry, molecular biology, archaeology, ethology, animal behavior, that we're really beginning to get a feel for what it was to be human. And clearly there have been sudden departures, which may have been triggered by events that if you like, in quotes, weren't anticipated but have been beneficial. But I think serendipity plays a minimal role, if any role at all, in those events per se, although it's played a critical role in our discovering what those events were and how we've become what we are. But I think as time goes on, we will learn a lot more. One of the last things I'd like to touch on, and I don't want to end this a little too early, but a little early perhaps, for reasons which you'll understand, an intermission 5 minutes before the end is bad form. One of the intriguing things is climate change, and today we're all very conscious of climate change. And clearly throughout this long story, the impact of climate on organisms that were about has been critical. And I don't think there's any doubt at all that the issue of climate change has played a far greater role in evolution and adaptation in terms of our own species than many of us give credit for. And I think we are still in an age where some people think climate change is a matter for taking it or leaving it. I think what we're seeing is the onset of a process that we're, if you like, accelerating, that could and will have huge implications on what happens to our organism as a species. Modern, bipedal, thinking, talking, communicating humans are going to be impacted in a very dramatic way in a relatively short space of time. Whether a short space of time is a decade or whether it's 100 years or 1,000 years, in terms of several million years of history, this will be very brief. And I think we really need to pay much more attention to some of these issues and encourage our political leadership in the various countries where we're from not to minimize the fact that we are a species that manifestly demonstrates that we have always been impacted by climate change. And there's absolutely no reason at all to believe that we won't be continually. But which way this can go? Could this be the first time that serendipity could be brought to play, where we have a faculty to exploit adaptations and chances that we hadn't thought about before? I would think it could be, and perhaps sometime in the future, Darwin College will have another series on this discussion, and they will recognize that finally, serendipity has had a role to play in our succession and survival as a species. I don't know. But climate change has to be tied into too much of that. So to summarize, I'm a skeptic on serendipity per se. I think we've, as a species, been quite successful. We do things like talk. As many of you know, part of the problems facing us all today is that while we do talk, we don't actually communicate. And I think one of the great specializations of humanity is that somehow we haven't actually exploited our complex system of communication. Maybe it's too complex. At least if you're a social insect, like a termite or a bee, you get the message and you do as you're told. With us, you don't get the message and you very rarely do as you're told. And that's led to all the troubles that we're facing. So that hasn't helped. Technology, well, it's a double-edged sword. Did it come about because of serendipity? No, but I think it's in a sense, you might say it has, although I don't see that as real. But I do think serendipity has played, in the sense that it's used as an English word, a huge role in the sequence of discoveries, and it's impacted dramatically on the discoverers rather than the discovered. And I guess, as somebody who's not really thought about serendipity until I was invited here, and don't really plan to think much more about it once I leave here, I hope you've been entertained and learned a little bit about this rebel from Kenya who dropped out of high school but has tremendous fun doing everything he does. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, what a wonderful ending to this series. We've certainly learnt a bit about what serendipity might involve in anthropology and archaeology of anthropology. It involves hard work. It involves infinite patience. It involves optimism. It involves getting research grants. And it involves being kicked in the head and shot at. But I think, for me, what I'll take away from this is, from this fascinating talk, has been that for all the clever technical science that's involved, rightly, in archaeology, it's the humanity of insight as much as anything that informs our understanding of the origins of our emergence as people. So can I thank, and can we all thank, Richard Leakey for this fascinating talk. Thank you very much. And now, since this is the end, can I bother you briefly with two things? The first is to thank the whole team that puts these lectures on. I'm just the front person. I'd particularly like to mention Mark Durand and Ian Morley, who organised the programme and made it all work. And I'd also like to mention Richard and Anne King, whose financial support for the series is one of the things that keeps us independent, which is a huge asset. Now, as Professor Leakey said, we don't know very much about what the future will bring, but we do know what's going to happen next year. And unless you've been living under a stone, you'll be aware that the next year is a very particular bicentenary, and it's a bicentenary of the birth of Charles Darwin, and it's the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. So we thought we'd devote the series to looking at where different approaches have come to with Darwinism, how they've been affected by Darwin's thoughts, and how the subject has moved on since Darwin's thoughts. So I do hope you'll come. Same time next year, you'll all be very welcome. Thank you.